Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The British Empire once was vast, powerful, greedy, and ruthless, and focused on mostly one thing, food. That's the story behind how Britain's search for ingredients set the stage for its expansion from India to New England, Barbados, and Africa. A new book about the history of the British Empire tells the story through its hunger for food. Each chapter begins with a meal and then deconstructs the cuisine to explore its place in British history. Joining us now by phone is historian and author Lizzie Collingham. Her new book is entitled Taste of Empire, How Britain's Quest for Food Changed the Modern World. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hi.
The British version was entitled Hungry Empire, which I thought was more appropriate. And I was wondering why the difference. I know titles are different a lot of times between the UK and America.
That was the American publishers. They said the Hungry Empire made it sound like the Hungry Hippos or something. They didn't like it. They thought people wouldn't think it was serious enough, I think.
I thought so Empire was confusing, though.
I prefer the Hungry Empire.
Your larger point in the book is that the food system of the British Empire kind of kickstarted the development of the global economy.
Yeah, I mean, the British Empire is an enormous force for globalization. Before that, of course, the Portuguese and the Spanish empires were weaving webs of trade around the world. But the British force, the British Empire really gives it another push and creates incredibly intricate webs connecting all kinds of people who have no knowledge of each other, but whose livelihoods depend on each other's consumption of the goods that the others produce and so on. So that's sort of, yeah, it's an enormous, powerful push for globalization.
When did Great Britain first get a taste for foreign foods?
Oh, well, you know, way back. So in the medieval period already, they were importing spices along the Silk Route and through Arabia and up through Venice and across. So spices were coming into Britain. All kinds of foreign foods were reaching Britain early on. And the British imported so many Italian currants that the Italians thought that they must be using them as for a dye, and so they couldn't believe they could be eating that many. So foreign foods have been going around, but those were eaten by the elites and they were very expensive. And it's only with the creation of the empire and the creation of shipping routes, which allows you to bring goods in bulk and in vast quantities, that brings down the prices, and then they become mass consumer items.
We are talking about the British Empire's quest for food. The author, Lizzie Collingham, of The Taste of Empire, How Britain's Quest for Food Shaped the Modern World. We're going to be talking about it all hour. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Why did the development of the empire change the affordability of the food from other countries?
Well, let's take sugar. Sugar is one of the really important things. So in the 1640s, a group of adventurous young men had colonized the island of Barbados. They tried out lots of different cash crops, couldn't find one that worked, tried tobacco, but by the time it reached Britain, it was smelly and moldy, and they couldn't sell that. And a chap called James Drax went across to Brazil, where they grew sugar, and bought some sugar, came back, learned how to process it and turn it into sugar, and he started sending sugar back to Britain from Barbados. I mean, just a few barrels at first, but very soon, millions of barrels of sugar started arriving at the port in London. And as soon as you get much more coming in, the price dropped and people were able to buy it. And so sugar really becomes a mass thing. You could buy it if you were a singing master or a laborer or a peasant.
You know, you call them adventurous young men, but of course this industry of sugar was built on the backs of enslaved human beings. They were slave traders.
Absolutely. Well, not at first. So those 50 young men who go out and colonize Barbados, they actually clear they bring in Amerindians from Brazil, who they claim actually came voluntarily. But most of the labor in the early plantation period was white indentured labourers. So criminals or poor people, vagrants in Britain were persuaded to go out for 5 years to work for a term and then were allowed to set themselves up with land at first. So at first they were white indentured labourers who were clearing those sugar fields. But at about the same time that Drax brings back sugar, a slave ship on its way to South America calls in at the port in Barbados, and the plantation owners start buying slaves. And yes, indeed, sugar is grown on the back and eaten on the backs of slave labor. A chap, a ship's purser later in the 18th century who goes on a voyage around the West Indies says, "I never more will put sugar in my tea, for it is nothing but Negro's blood." So, he realizes the horror of the slave trade, and he abhors sugar after that. And so, yes, it was a brutal thing.
Unlike tobacco, it turned out Indian pale ale improved with the passage of time. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, there were a bunch of merchants with factories or warehouses in India, and the East India Company would always send them out some British goods, to some cheeses and so on, and hams and jams, and also some beer. And they took stock beer, which is a kind of beer that the aristocrats put in their cellars and kept over the winter months, and it improved with time. So they thought, that's a good beer to send out to India. They put lots of hops in it, and that kept it for a long time. And they discovered that actually the rolling around in the barrels and the length of the journey and the going through all that heat actually improved the beer. And they fiddle around with it, put some more hops in, and that's how you get Indian pale ale. It's the same story with Madeira. So they discovered that. So Madeira was just like, you know, van de table, and it was, Madeira was on lots of trade routes. So it got put on in pipes on lots of ships. So they didn't put it in barrels. They put it in these long pipes, and then they rolled around, and the long journeys went through lots of heat, and they discovered, that makes it much better. And then they got the wine traders got lots of letters back from people saying, this wine was really, it was really good. And they worked out which voyages and how much heat that the wine had been subjected to. And they started spiking it with a bit of brandy. And then they discovered that West Indians liked it dark and sweet. And the Carolina rice planters liked it white and dry. And so they started adapting their wine. They even built special rooms on Madeira where they would simulate a voyage and roll the pipes around and heat them up and so on. So that's how Madeira came about as well. So it's a funny story.
It actually changed production.
Absolutely. I mean, Madeira then becomes an enormous wine-producing country, island, and becomes quite wealthy on the back of it.
You begin the story in the 16th century with a bit about Newfoundland salt cod, and you wrote that it laid the foundations of the empire. Can you talk about that?
People always think that the British Empire starts with that search for spices and going to the east and so on. But actually, in 1495, was it, that when John Cabot went to Newfoundland and discovered the cod off the shores of the coast of Canada, he was looking for the way to the East Indies. He was looking for a route to the Spice Islands, but of course America was kind of in the way, so he came to America. And sailors and the fishermen discovered that this was an immensely rich area for fish. So when they went there at first, they discovered that they could hardly row their boat through the seas. The seas were heaving with cod at certain times of year, and so thick with fish that they actually couldn't get through it. So that's how the fishing trade started. The new West countrymen would go out in the spring, set up little fishing stations on the coast, catch cod, salt it, cure it, bring it, dry it, bring it back. And that's how the going across the Atlantic became a routine kind of thing. There was this pool of people who could navigate the seas and act as sailors on these other trips when they went in search of the Indies. So it sets up the whole sort of sea exploration, and it also created. They had a great foodstuff. They could travel. They took salt beef, but they could also take salt cod to eat on these long voyages, and so on. So salt cod actually is really the first foodstuff that sets them off and sets them on the way towards empire.
They're figuring, well, if we can get enough of something and transport it safely, we can make a ton of money.
Well, they learned that, you know, the British didn't actually really eat that much salt cod. They used it to feed the military, they used mm-hmm. it to feed sailors, they fed the soldiers who were putting down rebellions in Ireland, but the British people themselves didn't actually like salt cod that much. But the people that were living around the Mediterranean really liked salt cod. So they could take it there and exchange it for sack wine, which is the Spanish for not very good wine, actually, that they made for export, and bring it back and get olive oil. And so that it showed them how to have trading triangles. They learned how to trade in a circle, in a way, and created that first web that set them off. And it also, it's all of that, you know, sailing across the Atlantic in that period was difficult. No one knew what was out there. No one knew how to negotiate the winds and the currents. And it's often counterintuitive. You have to sail in the wrong direction to pick up a wind or a current that will take you to where you eventually want to go. And they learned about all of that by sailing across the Atlantic every year and back again with their cod and farm.
How long did that cod business last?
Oh, I mean, ages. I mean, the British really get going with it in the 1570s. So the Basques, who were there initially, their fishing trade dies down for all kinds of complicated reasons in Spain. And so the British take over and stay there for a very long time, until into the 17th century. And then as emigrants settle in New England and so on, the cod trade also moves down the coast. So New England becomes fish and salt cod becomes the biggest export good that in New England, and that's New England's wealth is founded on salt cod as well. So it goes, you know, the trade goes on well into the 18th, 19th century in salt cod.
We're talking about the food of the British Empire. My guest is Lizzie Collingham. She is the author of a new book. It's entitled The Taste of Empire, How Britain's Quest for Food Shaped the Modern World. If you have a question or comment for Lizzie Collingham, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll continue our conversation when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about how the British Empire's quest to feed itself grew the empire around the globe from India to colonial America. Still with us is historian and author Lizzie Collingham. Her new book is entitled Taste of Empire, How Britain's Quest for Food Shaped the Modern World. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, Lizzie, getting back to the sugar issue, I was surprised to read that as early as the 17th century, doctors were beginning to realize that sugar could be unhealthy. Before, it was considered a perfect food, and it cracked me up that they put it on their bacon and eggs.
I know, it's brilliant, isn't it? So, yeah, I mean, in the Hippocratic dietetics, sugar is seen as really perfect because it's neither too warm nor too cold, too dry or too wet. And so you sprinkle it on anything, and it makes it a perfect balanced meal for any kind of humoral, you know, everybody was trying to keep all their humors in balance. And so that makes it anything nice and balanced for you. And so, yes, there's a botanist who's going around Britain in the early 18th century, and he complains they still murder good bacon and eggs in the dressing, and she's complaining because they put brown sugar on bacon and eggs. But that was, you know, in the medieval period, it was quite normal. Sugar, you'd sugar glaze roast meat, or you'd put it in your wine, which we still like, but or you'd put sugar in everything. You did, I mean, mince pies, which we all in Britain still have for Christmas, we don't put the meat in anymore, but they used to be made with meat and spices and sugar and fruit. So, yeah, sugar was, but in the 18th century, they start to realize, or 17th century, they start to realize, tooth decay, maybe, obesity, or gout. They blame gout on sugar. They think the British couldn't get enough sugar. They ate so much sugar compared to the rest of Europe. The British really ate a lot ton.
Yeah,
it's worrying.
Yeah, it's funny because we think that that's kind of a modern day problem, but it dates way back. And also, I thought it was interesting that, you know, when it started to be frowned upon, people still wanted their fix. So that's how they started putting it in their tea a lot.
Exactly. I mean, it's hard to prove, but I think possibly people drank so much tea because it was an okay way to take sugar. So there are two medical texts which suggest that you could take sugar in a better way by putting it in a bitter herbal infusion. They don't actually mention tea, but tea is a bitter herbal infusion. So put it in your tea, and then you can glug down as much sugar as you like. And tea and sugar grow, the rate of use of these two grow exponentially. They grow together. So they both double, it's 20-fold, 15-fold their use. During the 18th century, more and more people, and until the working classes really rely on their heavily sugared tea for a lot of their energy to work in the industrial, in the factories, making the textiles and all that kind of stuff. It becomes a foundational food for the working classes in Britain.
Rebecca in Columbus, you're on the air with Lizzie Collingham. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi. I love this topic. This is far up my alley. I have a question for you. Well, first of all, concerning the sugar, isn't that also partly because of its preservative benefits, putting it in meat and so forth, that would lead to a benefit apart from the flavor?
Yeah, I mean, in the medieval period, you might use sugar, yeah, as part of your preservatives. And it kicks off as well in the 17th century. People make jams a lot, and suddenly you can use a lot more fruits because you can make fruit jams and fruit pies and things like that. So yeah, sugar is a really hugely useful thing, and once it becomes affordable, it's a wonderful thing. So you can put, but mainly you'd pickle things in vinegar and.
Let me ask you, what was your light bulb moment for this? I mean, you're a food historian. At what point did you realize that food was driving the political expansion of Great Britain?
Well, I guess my last book was about food in the Second World War. And I had a light bulb moment then when I realized that food security was, and the worries about being food insecure in Japan and Germany were driving them towards aggression. They were looking for their own empire, looking for their own way of having a closed system which would make them independent from trade with the rest of the world to feed their populations. And so I realized how important that food underlies a lot of political decision making while I was writing that book about the Second World War. And that's why, in a way, I kind of then turned back. I'm a historian of the empire. I wrote about the British in India and their bodies for my first book. So I kind of turned back to what I knew already and thought, I wonder if you follow food, if you follow the money, if you follow the food, you uncover all kinds of processes.
Thanks, Rebecca, for that question. I mean, in a way, though, the empire building piece of this surely succeeded, obviously, for a long time. But it also made Great Britain dependent on outside sources for its food. I think I read that 90% of its fats and sugars come from outside, and about 50% of its beef. I might be wrong.
Right.
Yeah.
No, you're right. Meat.
It's 50%.
By the 1930s. Basically, the British working classes are fed on imports from the empire. That's right. So what they do is they run down their agricultural sector in the 19th century, 18th, 19th century, and it becomes a very small part of society. That surplus labor who are unemployed on the fields go into the factories and make textiles, or they leave. They go elsewhere. They go to Australia, New Zealand, America, and they set up farms or go into farming there and produce enough food on other people's land to feed the working classes who are making the manufactures back in Britain. So it's very a round, kind of satisfying for Britain, a round circle.
And now it's still the same situation.
No.
Okay.
Now, after the Second World War, things changed. So with the agricultural revolution, you can increase yields a lot. So Britain goes back to being an exporting country.
Okay.
When it comes to food. But we're still very dependent on Europe, actually, for our food. It's no longer the empire we're dependent on. It's Europe we're dependent on for food. And we're dependent on exporting our food manufactures to Europe. So that was, you know, it just shifts.
Any concerns with Brexit?
Yes. Huge. They are huge. Food is estimated to go up in Britain by 20-30% if we leave the European Union and go on to World Trade Organization agreement. It's a crazy, crazy situation.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Lizzie Collingham. She's an historian and author. Her new book is entitled Taste of Empire, How Britain's Quest for Food Shaped the Modern World. If you have a question or comment for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. How did you choose the dinners that you start each? I had just a lot of fun going through the table of contents, and I loved how you kind of arrayed them in the way you did.
I was really happy with my titles.
Yeah.
I've got things like In Which Sarah Harding and Her Family
exactly.
Grow Fat,
yeah.
Eating Plenty of Good Food. And I was really worried that nobody else would like the way I'd done it, but actually everybody is.
I really like it, yeah.
Yeah, and that's fun. And it tells you what's in the chapter, but in a fun way. So how did you, I set myself an enormously difficult challenge. I hadn't thought it through that carefully. I just thought, oh, it'll be easy. I'll find a meal that sort of illustrates what I'm trying to talk about. So I searched and searched through all kinds of primary sources, memoirs. The one actually that I like, in some ways, that was the most intricate to put together was the slaves in South Carolina,
yeah.
Because there are no records of what it was like to be a slave in the 18th century in America. There are records of what it's like to be a slave in the 19th century in Carolina, and there's some, and I, of course, read all those accounts, but there's nothing. So I looked at archaeology, and I looked at a dig that archaeologists have done lots of digging, a refuse pits around slave cabins, and they can put together what they ate and what they were making and what goes in. So I put it together through that. So, yeah, I had enormous fun with that. And I discovered that, then they discovered that all this pottery, that looks kind of, everybody thought it was made by the Native Americans. And actually, then another archaeologist said, yeah, but that looks just like the pottery that I dig up in Ghana. And then they realized that, no, the Africans had brought over their own technology and their own ways of making pots, and we're still using them in South Carolina. So I had enormous fun researching that meal. But it took a lot of digging with a lot of them. And I was so happy when I came across my Irish one. So I have a really disgusting Irish meal in the second chapter. So this chap goes to stay with some people, and he describes how the woman of the house starts to grind his oats, and she pulls up her skirt, and she's not wearing anything. He's no shrinking violet, but he doesn't know where to look. And then she puts her arm in to churn the butter, and he sees all the sweat trickling down from her armpits into the butter, and he's utterly disgusted and can't eat the food. That was such a brilliant description of a meal, even though it's
a horrible
prejudiced
meal
and biased. I thought it was so funny that I had to put that in.
You used a story from Charles Dickens. And I kind of heard about that story before, but I wouldn't have been able to place it. Tell us about that. It's a Christmassy.
Oh, yeah, that's my last meal. So that's Mr. Oldknow. It's from Dickens' Household Words. It was probably written by one of his collaborators on that magazine. And Mr. Oldknow is on Christmas Eve, and he falls asleep after romping around with his children on Christmas Eve, and he falls asleep in front of the fire in the kitchen. His wife has taken him down. She's shown in the mixture for the Christmas pudding the next day that they're going to make, and he falls asleep and he dreams up the smoke from his pipe turns into all these genies, he calls them, and people bringing in all the ingredients from all around the world that would go into the Christmas pudding. And it shows how to be a Victorian Englishman was to eat the world, that the Christmas pudding was seen as this British national dish, but it was British, and because it was made with ingredients from all over, so raisins from Greece and sugar, of course, from the West Indies and all those sorts of things. I mean, the wheat is actually a British farmer, but it could just as well have been an American farmer who brings the wheat. So it's all about how it shows how trade is making Britain great. It's kind of the story that the Brexiteers keep harping back to now, and that they're living in this illusory world that we're still a great nation trading with all these people, and they forget that in actual fact that there was a great deal of brutality and exploitation and the suppression of other people's ways of eating and agriculture that went with that trade. It wasn't such a happy vision as Mr. Oldknow's story makes it out to be.
Yeah, when I'm reading it, and I didn't read the original, but when I'm reading your version of it, there's a little politics mixed in there.
Oh, yeah. It's about free trade. He's very much in favor of free trade, and he thinks that, you know, if you're a free trade, and also the idea is that if you trade freely with other countries, you will encourage the natives, they sort of people who lived elsewhere, to be more industrious and create more things in order to buy British products. So yeah, there's a lot of politics in that story. It's very 19th century free trading politics.
Charlotte in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Charlotte.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I remember being on active duty back in Tacoma, Washington, and we took a tour of a sugar refinery in Vancouver, very famous name. You'll find their golden syrup at most supermarkets in America these days, United States. But what impressed me about the tour, and it looked like they had bulldozers of refined sugar. And it was cheaper then to deal for them to draw their sugar cane over the water from Australia in the British Commonwealth than it was to import their own internal sugar beet or U.S. sugar beet by land over the Rocky Mountains. So I would posit that the remnants of that British Empire trade cycle are still extant, but it's through the British Commonwealth.
Hmm. That's fascinating. I didn't know that at all. Yeah, I mean, sugar beet actually is starts in the Second World War. In Britain, it's a Napoleonic thing. It starts during, they look for sugar, a way of getting sugar so they don't have to import it during the Napoleonic Wars in France. And then it's subsidized in Britain for the same reason. They worry that if there's during the First World War and the Second World War, that they won't be able to import enough sugar and they grow sugar beet. But it's always been subsidized. Growing sugar beet is and processing it is not a very economically as effective as importing it as sugar cane.
Thanks, Charlotte, for that call. Anybody else? 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. American colonists were well fed by the 18th century. I mean, a lot of times we hear about the very, very early days of, you know, the settlers and how they were starving a lot of times. Mm. But by the 18th century, you know, when they were fighting in the Revolutionary War, I was really shocked to see how differently they were in stature.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something like 10 centimeters taller, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Like 3.5 inches, yeah.
Yeah, no, the Americans are incredibly well fed. So, yes, I mean, there's these awful stories. In the early days, you know, people they couldn't establish their crops. They were living off the food that they brought over in the ships and anything they could get from the Native Americans, if they trade with them and so on. And it was very, very difficult to establish farming at first. I mean, they came for land, but they didn't have enough labor. So to cut down trees and dig up the roots and plow the fields to grow wheat, it's very difficult. So they end up growing maize, and they think of maize as pig food. So they kind of, it's a bit embarrassing that at first you end up eating pig food. They dig for clams in the beaches, and that's kind of muddy and poor, seen as poor people's food. So yeah, the early years are hard and difficult, and but eventually, yeah, Americans get going. They establish farms. They learn how to grow wheat in certain areas. They establish trading links. So in those areas that don't grow wheat so well, where they get rust, they grow rye and exchange it. They end up liking maize and growing corn and eating cornbread. And yeah, by the 18th century, probably the Americans are the best fed people in the entire world. They have abundant food and are doing extremely well. So that shows in height. So if you're as a child, if you don't eat well enough as a child, and certainly in Britain, the laborers were not getting very much good nutritious food, and certainly not enough meat. That then, if you're ill, all the nutrients are used to help you get over the illness, rather than put into growing into height, and that's why you'd end to get stunted growth. And so the Americans are very well off and doing very well. And this this translates through into height. And you know, that's one of the reasons why people emigrated. You know, they always think, we always think they were looking for the streets being paved in gold in America. But actually, they were thinking of the dining tables groaning under meat. And they all write their letters back, the emigrants write back to their poor laboring families left behind, saying, I eat meat three times a day. I eat steaks for breakfast. And so that's one of the pulls. And that's one of the reasons why people emigrate from Britain in the 19th century. They're looking for food. They want to feed their families.
Is there any sense or evidence that that made a difference in the Revolutionary War?
Oh, I'm not an expert on all the Revolutionary Wars. I'm a hopeless military historian. Mm-hmm. I should have thought it probably does. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. Okay. I mean, they were very worried during the Boer War that the British working classes weren't really up to standard for soldiers and weren't really fit enough. So I should imagine, you know, it will have been a problem with the British soldiers, won't have been as healthy and strong as the Americans. But whether that really plays through, I have no idea.
We are talking about the British Empire and how its quest for food changed, affected, you know, created and kickstarted a global economy. My guest is Lizzie Collingham. She's a historian and author. Her new book is entitled Taste of Empire, How Britain's Quest for Food Shaped the Modern World. If you have a question or comment, we welcome them. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about how the British Empire's quest to feed itself grew the empire around the globe, from India to colonial America. Still with us is historian and author Lizzie Collingham. Her new book is entitled Taste of Empire, How Britain's Quest for Food Shaped the Modern World. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. There were obviously unintended consequences. The British Empire's quest for food in East Africa had a horrible impact on the indigenous diet there. What happened?
Well, the problem was that the British thought that they were very arrogant about And this stems right from the very early Tudor period, that they'd learned how to improve agriculture. The way they grew crops was the best way. They wanted to export the plow to Ireland, and that was what they wanted to do in America. They struggled to plow the fields in America. And it's in the 20th century, you find them still wanting to improve the way the indigenous people grew their crops. They couldn't possibly be doing it right. And in Africa, the Kenyans would do exactly what the Native Americans did in those early days in the when the colonists first arrived in America. They grew their maize, their beans, and intercropped everything all together, and millet and beans, and that was the basis of the diet. But the British decided that they needed more maize because they would use maize to feed the workers who were navvies who were building the railways and so on. And so they encouraged them to grow maize, and they also encouraged them to grow maize single cropping so that they wouldn't intercrop them with beans because that looked untidy, and they were convinced that that wouldn't be the highest yielding way to grow maize. But of course, what that does is it mines the fertility out of the soil, so mm-hmm. you end up with very poor soil. And maize is also very sensitive to drought, and it needs water at exactly a particular time when it's growing and so on. Millet is much more resistant. So they introduce a food that is not very drought secure. And then they also introduce a food without the Mesoamerican technology. So you in Mexico, you put maize in a lime bath and boil it in lime, and then you grind it. And that way the human body is able to break down and digest the vitamin B and the proteins in maize. But if you don't do that to maize first, then the body doesn't have a way to access those nutrients. And they don't introduce that into Africa. And so you get Africans relying on a poor crop which doesn't give them sufficient nutrients. So the British arrogance in deciding that they know what's best with agriculture, they know how to do it properly, and imposing it on the people, it has a very poor impact and very hard impact on East Africa. And East Africans now think they're so used to eating maize that the British had such an enormous campaign to introduce it that now a lot of Africans aren't aware that it's not an indigenous crop. They think of it as the maize of the ancestors, and they think of maize as an African food, when in fact it's an American crop.
Did the British come to understand this and change their ways?
Not until after they'd left. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, it's not entirely. No, they didn't understand entirely what they were doing. It's arrogance and it's hubris. It's not a conspiracy theory mm-hmm. to destroy people's diets. But it's only later that when people understand, how nutrition works, how plants work, and mm-hmm. so on, that they come to see that. So no, it's not till much later that dawns on people, and that's not the way. When the 1960s, there's a movement towards actually we should follow the farming practices that people have been using for centuries, because there's a reason why those farming practices have developed.
And that was really fascinating to me. The Mesoamericans understood the lime bath and how they came to understand that and what the difference was and why it made a difference.
That's one of those mysteries that lies back in, how did people come to know that cassava would be okay to eat? It's got this toxic prussic acid, and that if you grate it and let it drip out, then it will be okay to eat cassava. Those are early wheat, I guess. Even wheat wasn't particularly great before. I mean, people experimented, I guess, early in the, really
sometime.
Early when you're hunter-gatherers, you experiment with what you can eat and see how you can produce some food out of something. So that's, that's a really early technology that they learn, and they fail to take that technology. They do take the cassava technology with them to Africa. The conquistadors and the Portuguese, they do take that to the West African coast. So the Africans too learn how to grate cassava.
A famine in India killed as many as 16 million Indians between 1875 and 1914. And about that time, Britain's wheat imports, a fifth of them came from India. How was famine connected to the export of wheat? Did they take out the wheat at the expense of the Indians?
Well, it's a bit more complicated than that. Okay. But, I mean, it's not just one long famine. Famine keeps on occurring in different parts of India through those periods. And, and an awful lot of people die. And the problem is that the market economy goes into India. So it reaches in the roads, railways, grain stores. The market reaches into these rural areas where before you might have stored that grain in case you had a drought the next year or in case you needed more. It now makes more sense to sell it because you'll get more money. The trouble is if you sell it and then there's a drought, it's the people who rely on buying food every day who don't have any stores or any backup, and they don't have any means of making any more money. As wheat becomes more expensive, they can't buy in food, and they're the people who are hurt by drought and so on. So as stores fade away and you get inflation if there's a drought or something like that, then people lose their right to food. And so that's how famine happens, because it makes more sense when you can still make money exporting wheat to Britain, you're going to do that as a merchant. You're not going to worry about the poor people who need to buy the food every day. So it's a complicated, but it's because of the market intrusion into Indian rural settings, which aren't really robust enough to withstand the market forces.
Britain's relationship with India when it comes to food is pretty fascinating. I mean, there's the whole curry story, which I want to get to. But how did Britain, what was the relationship with Britain before it colonized India? They did regular trading with them, right?
Yeah, so the British go in search of spices and first they want pepper, and so pepper is good in Kerala, they can buy it in pepper, and they want spices, and they set up a trading factory in Surat. But the price of pepper quickly falls in Europe because the Dutch East India Company is also set up, and they actually flood Europe with pepper, and there's too much, and it loses its value. But they discover that if they buy India's textiles, they can trade them in the Spice Islands for spices and swap. And that by that point, they've discovered that Indian textiles also sell really well in Europe and Britain. So they want to have warehouses in India. So they set up little factories, which is their name for warehouses, all around the coast in Bengal and Madras and so on, and start trading in textiles in India. And that way they become merchants. And then very gradually, it's a complicated process, but they get drawn into local conflicts. And the East India Company gets its own army in India, and it fights against the French, but they ally with other Indians and so on. And they eventually end up being granted the Nawabcy of Bengal. So they're allowed to collect taxes and administer Bengal, and they pay tribute to the Mughal emperor back in Delhi, just like any other Indian ruler would do. And that's how the East India Company kind of establishes itself on Indian ground. And then gradually they take over more and more parts of the subcontinent. So it's a complicated process. And while that's going on and there are all these traders, they, of course, learn to eat Indian food and love it. And so that's how Indian food, the relationship with between Britain and India's food takes off.
Hello, curry, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, curry is a British name for, they pick up, they say, what are these people eating? You know, what's that? And they say, oh, well, it's curry. Quite often the Portuguese had already asked the same question. They've been told, oh, it's curry. And curry is often a kind of, it's not really what you would, you know, Indian would say they're eating curry. They'd say, I'm eating dry roast beef, or I'm eating, I don't know, chicken stir fry or whatever. Mm-hmm. They have a name for every dish. But curry somehow gets picked up by the Europeans and just applied as a generic term for whatever Indians are eating. And so that's curry isn't really a thing. It's a British thing.
I think I read somewhere, I don't think it was anything you wrote, but maybe you did write it, that it's the new fish and chip, the curry is now the national food versus fish and chips.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Robin Cook claimed that chicken tikka masala was the British national dish.
Okay.
And yeah, yeah. And in many ways, it's true. The British have really taken curry to heart, and they changed it. They changed what happened. Curry, they look at what the Indians eat, they get them to cook for them, and then they bring the recipes home with them. And then they start fiddling with them, and they don't quite understand how to make Indian food themselves, and they invent curry powder. No Indian ever uses curry powder. They use freshly roasted and ground spices, and they use different spices for every dish. But the British kind of take shortcuts, and they make curry powder, and then they just fry some onions, stick some curry powder in, bit of meat and some water, and you've got a, hey presto, you've got a curry flavored stew, and that's what they think of as Indian food. So the British change Indian food enormously, and then there's a whole story of how it changes in Indian restaurants and so on. So what we eat and think of as curry, until very recently when a new wave of Indian chefs came in and showed us how to cook more sophisticated Indian food, that's really some kind of weird British interpretation of Indian food.
It was in the 60s when Indians still had British passports, and they started to migrate.
Yeah, Britain wanted migrants. Mm-hmm. They wanted people to come and work in their textile industries. The problem was that often they wanted to do night shifts, but British men didn't want to work a night shift or couldn't work night shifts, but the men want to work in textiles. So Indian men were perfectly happy to work in textiles, and they came and worked in the car industries and the rubber industries. And so we got an influx of, there was a big relationship between the two countries. And there was an influx of Indian immigrants who've enriched our country enormously, let alone the cuisine.
Exactly. So finally some decent curry. The restaurants are very popular.
Absolutely. I mean, they set up lots of, it's a long, long story, but they set up the first chefs were actually often from Sylhet, and they worked in the boiler rooms of the steamships. Horrible job, boilers hot, explode, nasty. So they would often jump ship, and they would set up little restaurants or cafes for each other. But then once the war had left quite a lot of bombed out cafes, they'd got some savings and they'd buy up these cafes. And they'd make the same food that the cafes made, to chips, and sell them to football people after they'd got men going home from football matches and things like that, which is why you have, and then they'd make curry sauces, and you dip your chips in curry sauce, and that's why you have curry and chips and the tradition of lager and going out and getting drunk and then stopping off and eating a curry. So all those traditions get going that way. So yeah, it's a very complex story. And then they open up more sophisticated restaurants. It's cheap, it's good, students like it, and it really takes off.
We're just about out of time, but I have to ask you, at the very end of the book, you have turkey curry a la Bridget Jones and Una's turkey curry buffet on New Year's Day. It's called Ruth's turkey
That's
curry.
My aunt.
Your aunt. Okay.
She makes turkey curry.
Okay. I'm going to try the recipe. How about that?
Okay, try it.
I can't wait. Lizzie, thank you so much. You've been great. I appreciate your time today.
Pleasure.
Lizzie Collingham, author of she's a historian and an author. Her new book is entitled Taste of Empire, How Britain's Quest for Food Shaped the Modern World. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.